Welcome back to Are You My Data? This is the third episode. I'm David Robertson and I am joined today by Anne Taves. Welcome back to the Religious Studies Project, Anne.
Thank you, David.
So the format here is we've solicited some questions from listeners for Anne on all aspects of academic life, from practicalities to her work to the field and everything in between. And we've got a lot to get through. So I will kick off with a question I think a lot of people worry about, especially early in their career. And this question comes from Inge Hovland. And the question is, how do you fit in time for reading and writing and thinking? Lots of people have different approaches to writing, but what is yours? What does your process look like? And as an extension of that, do you have any thoughts on how to organize writing for people who have a high teaching load?
I tend to use compartmentalizing to get writing time. When I was teaching at Claremont, we were encouraged actually to take a day a week as a writing day. So I continue to try to do that even when I'm teaching, but I've always been lucky to have fairly medium to relatively light teaching loads, so I had space to do that. So in addition to compartmentalizing and setting aside a chunk of time, if that's not possible due to a heavy teaching load, another thing that I would consider thinking about is what part of the day you write the best. For me, that's the morning. I wake up in the morning thinking and writing stuff in my head half the time if I'm in the middle of working on something. So even taking, say an hour or even, like an hour in the morning before I have to do other stuff would be a way for me to squeeze in writing. If, I had little kids and a heavy teaching job, I realize that might get more and more impractical, but I think that's the way I would try to do it. I mean, there becomes a point where if there's just too many things on a person's plate, if they're really trying to do everything, that can get totally overwhelming. I mean, I got married late and I didn't have kids, and that's part of the reason that I could be as productive as I've been. So even though people don't like to think this, I think there still tends to be trade-offs.
Yeah, absolutely. Carol Cusack said pretty much the same thing. Do you compartmentalize in other ways then? Are you quite focused in that you are working on kind of one thing at a time? Or is it more that when you have writing time, you just write and you might have different things on the go at the same time?
Oh, you mean do I compartmentalize my writing?
Yeah, like are you as organized with the focus of your work, are you as focused with the outputs as you are with how you control the time?
Pretty much. Because the thing is, I have to sink into any particular writing piece and really assemble all the lines of thought that are connected to it. And it's hard to do that with more than one piece at a time if they're coming from different directions. So, yeah, I tend to, my way of doing things is to be as organized as possible. If I'm not organized, I tend to get pretty anxious because I feel like it's all just coming at me and I have no idea how any of it, including, and I don't just mean the writing, I mean all of life. I just start to feel overwhelmed. So yeah, I like to put things in compartments. And so in my writing space, you know, I'll look at what the deadlines are for things, and I'll look at what's flexible. And so I'll try to estimate how long it's going to take to do something, and so carve out spaces in which I'm going to focus on some particular writing project for this period of time. And then I can turn to that other one, and I'll have left enough time to do it before I have to present it at some meeting or something like that.
I've got a few questions here about your writing. I suppose there's a link for you. I'm just thinking, what's the best order here? Okay. So there's a few questions about sort of explanation and interpretation and the sort of cognitivist, critical, various sort of approaches. The first one is, this comes from Matt Baldwin. Where do you stand on the question of explanation versus interpretation as the goal of religious studies?
Well, I definitely think that we should have the option of explaining, and I'm working with Evel Asprom right now on a little book on explaining. To me, there's a kind of gray line. I mean, there's a blurry boundary between description, interpretation, and explanation. So I tend to think of it in terms of interpretation as kind of analytical, descriptive work, where we're digging into the sources and trying to figure out how to understand what they're trying to say. And as long as we're sticking to terms that our subjects would recognize, even if we're digging deeper and making connections that maybe they haven't thought about, I would still put that in the descriptive category, even if it's more, like I said, deeply analytical than you know, the subjects themselves might have considered it. Explanation for me shifts into terms other than the subject would use to understand what's going on. I mean, we can ask them how they would explain what's happening, and I think that's really important, but again, that's part of how they're understanding things, and I put analyzing that still back in the descriptive category. I guess where I come out, or my problem with the interpretation issue is that a lot of times when we use that, we're not always being real clear about the voice that we're using, and we draw in theoretical frameworks to recast what the subject's understanding without calling it an explanation, and without being really clear that we're shifting voices to our own voice from the subject's voice. So I guess I'm saying that I'm shying away from using the interpretive terminology, but I guess, and I'm thinking out loud here, if we go back to the old questions of Geisteswissenschaft and Naturwissenschaft and the division between the humanities and the sciences, that I think that we have a broadly descriptive, analytical, interpretive task that is always a first step in terms of understanding what people are saying in something like their own terms. And then I think we have the option and should have the right as academics to explain what we think is going on in terms that make sense to us, which in my case is often then scientific terms.
Yeah, good. What extent do you think that the kind of cognitive scientific evolutionary work that you're very keen on, it sounds, I mean it's stronger than that, but you know what I mean, that you're focusing on at the moment, how compatible is that with social constructionist explanations?
Oh, it's very compatible if you're not, or we're not pushing social constructivism to such an extreme that we think that everything is socially constructed, completely socially constructed. In other words, we don't have biological bodies, or our biological bodies are only socially constructed and there's no biology to them. Like, I guess you don't even need to have sex unless you think that sex is socially constructed. And also, if you think that the evolutionary process is simply a social construction or a matter of discourse, if you want to go there, then I think they're incompatible. But as long as you think that things like evolution really happened and that we really do have bodies, and if, you know, if our bodies, our heart stops and our brain stops, then, you know, like we die, then you can build a social constructivist point of view on top of that evolutionary biological foundation. And what becomes really interesting in that, I think, is the whole question of how it is that humans have evolved to be the animals that create the most diverse socio-cultural niches, or what we could call worlds, social worlds, cultures, that can differ as much as they do from one another. And so explaining how we can have this, how we can have evolved to have this ability to construct social worlds as part of our evolved nature, to me, is a really cool and interesting problem.
Yeah. I'd go along with you. I taught your theory this year, so I've been thinking about it quite a bit, and I was surprised how often both the students and the reviewers of your last couple of books missed the social constructive aspect of it, that you're often taken as writing about religious experience, but mostly you're actually arguing it's the process by which cognitive events become constructed as.
Yeah.
So the process of construction of social is inherently in your theory, but it gets missed all the time.
That's totally right. That's totally right. I mean, when I shifted, you know, with religious experience reconsidered, the whole point there was not to dismiss religious experience, but to shift from seeing it as an inherent something to seeing it as something that gets constructed, and focusing on the process of construction and why is it that, you know, certain out-of-body experiences, or to be sound psychiatric, hallucinatory experiences, or whatever, dissociative experiences, why do some of them lead people to these great insights and lead them to start new movements, and in other situations lead them to freak out their families and friends and wind up seeking clinical care because they're just seeming totally crazy.
One of the other questions here is, are you willing to speculate about the metaphysics of mind? And if not, why not?
are we talking here about things like, is the mind dependent on the brain? Can the mind leave the brain? Do I believe in the, or think the filter hypothesis is plausible? Those kinds of questions.
I mean, I think so. The question comes after the, from the same person as the explanation and interpretation, and then the relation of cognitivist and kind of constructionist. So I suspect that the person is pushing you in, well, you talk about brain events and you talk about the social world, but the brain isn't the mind.
Right. Okay. So what's the relationship between brain and mind?
And where does the mind come into your model?
If we're just starting there, that's kind of easy, because all of our sources, our, you know, as historians, ethnographers, humanities people, right? Mm-hmm. All of our sources, anytime anybody's talking to us about their experience, they're talking about how they experience it subjectively. And so they're describing their mind to us. So what we're aware of going on in ourselves is what I would call mind. The brain part is how it's all working biologically. I mean, if you think about a car and you think about our experience when we get in a car and we drive, that would be like the subjective part, the mind part, and all the part that we can see. But unless we're a mechanic or a car manufacturer, we're not digging into the engine. We're not thinking about what makes the car work. We're just getting in the car. We're turning it on. We're turning the wheel. We're driving. The brain part is all the part about how the whole thing is constructed, how it communicates within itself, how neurons fire, how networks connect, how different parts of the brain register different kinds of things. We're conscious, we're not aware of almost all of that. We haven't evolved to be aware of that. So there's so much processing that goes on that we simply cannot be aware of. And if you think about other animals, and you think about how much more self-aware we are as humans, how much more we're able to reflect on what's going on than other animals are, you realize that other animals do a heck of a lot of stuff without language, without being able to reflect on what they're doing. But they still do it all, or still do lots of stuff. And so all that stuff can be done without us being able to think or talk about it. Did that make sense?
It does, yeah. But given that the questioner specifically uses the term metaphysics, the metaphysics, let's push you a bit further in that direction.
Okay, so back to what I said at the beginning of the filter hypothesis and those kinds of things, right? That's where...
I think so, I mean...
Yeah. Okay. So I can refer to my friend Jeffrey Kripal at this point, because he and I go around this topic periodically because he actually is, as I understand it, pretty much a proponent of the filter hypothesis, the idea that consciousness is separable from the brain, that the brain functions to as a filter of some kind of larger sort of consciousness that then a portion of which we becomes available to us coming into our brains.
Right. Yeah. I think so as well. I mean, I think that's what Jeff thinks. I'm not saying that's
why. Yeah. So I can talk about this in several ways. I mean, first of all, I don't think any of us know the answer to these metaphysical questions for sure. So as Jeff and I have joked with each other, you know, we're putting bets on things. But Jeff and I are putting bets on somewhat different things. And my inclination is to see how far we can get with the kind of science that's emerging about how the brain works before going to ideas that, to me, seem less compatible with what we know scientifically. But some of the work that I've been doing recently on drug-induced or hallucinogen-induced experiences, some of which get characterized as mystical, has been really intriguing because of some of the new work that's coming out about how that's working neurologically. And in some of that research, they're going back to the filter hypothesis and talking about how hallucinogens, at least some of them, seem to take the kind of top level of executive processing and take that more offline so that what we're doing is a more primary dreamlike kind of processing. And what they're saying is that more executive control, higher level processing does sort of function like a filter. And so when we're taking hallucinogens, and I'm not actually speaking personally here, but when people take hallucinogens, it does mean that more information may be flooding into consciousness than normally would be. The issue here would be is where is that coming from? Is it coming from some kind of cosmic consciousness? I tend not to go there. In other words, I think that's unlikely. But again, that's just a bet. I think it's more likely that there is an incredible amount of information just in our environment, and that our brain is normally filtering out a whole lot of what's in our environment. And if we down-regulate our internal brain filters so that we allow more of that in, we can experience a lot more and our consciousness, so to speak, can be expanded.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I am speaking from experience, incidentally. I just want to get a conversation with you and Jeff on that at some point. Anyway, that's for another day. Okay, let's move on. I've got a couple of questions from Dave McConaughey here. The first one I think is a good transition. How has your presentation of religion as special things caught on in other fields, if indeed it has? Have there been any other uses of the idea outside of religious studies?
Yes, yeah. Actually.
Rather than us borrowing from anthropology or whatever, have other people borrowed from us for once?
Well, I was going to say, yes, there is at least one other person, but it turns out, but she didn't get the idea from me. I discovered she had had the idea after I wrote about it. So that's Ellen DeSaniaki, who is, I guess she's an art historian. She's a scholar of art, but she's very interested in evolutionary theories of art. And she wrote a book quite a while back, like in the 90s, on what is art, that totally cracked me up, because as a art scholar, she was asking all the same questions that we ask about religion. And then she went back to, you know, the evolution of art and talked about artifying, so, you know, the process of making art, and thought about, in an evolutionary framework, what does it mean to make art? And she said, it's about making things special. It's about taking an object and doing stuff with it, making it stand out, making it special relative to other objects that might, you know, other rocks, for example, or other cave walls. But in the process of talking about this, she also talked about how this would sacralize the object or ritualize the object. So again, what was amusing to me is that she couldn't make a clear distinction. She wasn't necessarily trying, but between art, sacrality, ritual, you know, or say making a tool, because that would definitely be a special object as well. So I'm on a riff here, but in effect, she then was part of inspiration for me in thinking about these evolutionary theories of religion, where I've been arguing with some of the people who want to talk about that in a more general way, but still call it religion. And I think that if we're not going to narrow an evolutionary view of religion to just talking about supernatural agents and when did we humans start envisioning supernatural agents, if we're going to talk about it more generally in terms of sacralizing things and ritual practices and that kind of stuff, then I think that we're talking about the emergence of culture more generally, and that we can't segment out art and religion and tools and, you know, planting and growing crops and how you do that. We're really talking about a way of life, and we're talking about ways of life that get increasingly complex and increasingly differentiated and have these abilities to make things special in ways that become important within a way of life.
Yeah, so it's super interesting, because art is in some ways the closest field to religious studies, to the degree that they're the two subjects where the discipline is almost entirely founded on a discussion of what our object is. And also where you have this constant debate between people who say, who claim that you can only know it with the special knowledge, right? It's an insider only. So, you know, even in art, you have these special agents who, you know, have access to sort of higher knowledge, being posited, you know, the sort of notion of geniuses. It's actually very interesting.
I think we can go farther than art, unless you're interpreting art really broadly. I think we can bring in music, literature, performance studies, you know, and drama. I mean, all of those things, and maybe you meant to encompass all that in art, but certainly with literature, the whole notion of narrative, I mean, the evolutionary folks are getting much clearer about the importance of being able to narrate stories to go along with the enactment of reenactment of events, you know, whether ritualized or not. So the narrative part seems really important, but ritual, what's ritual, you know, without music? But the ritual is also a performance. So it seems like a whole lot of the humanities, right? We segment out into our departments, and then we worry endlessly in the modern world about, you know, modern university, about what differentiates our departments.
Yes.
And try and reimpose that back on early human evolution. I just think that's a little bit nuts.
Yes, like sort of like we construct the field ourselves, right?
Right. Yes, yeah. We're social constructionists about everything but our discipline.
Yeah, absolutely true. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a story I've told before that I mean, I kind of try to go in the same direction in my PhD. I didn't define religion or talk about religion in the slightest. And this came up in my defense, and one of the examiners said, well, you know, that's us all out of a job then.
Yeah.
How's
that? Yeah, I know. That's one of the things that, I mean, I don't know if that's on your list of questions, but it is. I mean, that certainly is one of the practical questions, and we could discuss the.
I mean, it actually is. The question is this. We're under attack with moves to kill our departments. For those of us who have degrees in religion, we also have to take, we often have to take contingent jobs where the frame isn't religious studies, but rather religion and philosophy, or humanities, or liberal arts, or interdisciplinary studies, and so on. Is contingency having a special or particular effect on religious studies because of how we're variously located in social sciences or humanities, and only occasionally in departments devoted specifically to the academic study of religion? What can we do about this, and they say, to protect the field's most vulnerable faculty? If indeed we must protect the faculty, of course.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a really hard question, and it seems to presuppose the study of religion getting taken up or being taken up in a broad range of departments, which I guess I agree with. I mean, it can be part of sociology, psychology, as well as philosophy, to pick, you know, three big areas that would have a of religion component. Let me just come at it a little bit sideways in terms of how I've been thinking about things, which is, I mean, you know, because I was there talking about this stuff, the whole worldviews and ways of life idea, that I've been arguing that I think that we ought to subsume the study of religion under this, the scientific study of worldviews and ways of life, where we define worldviews in terms of big questions that Algol Aspram and I've been arguing other organisms, other animals have to answer these questions, just as a fact of being mobile organisms, but that humans can actually ask the questions and reflect on the questions, which adds in this whole other dimension that allows us to create these cultural worlds. So given that I've been arguing that, then I've been thinking about what that means for the discipline. And my best idea is that maybe I think religious studies departments, where we have actual religious studies departments, ought to take a clue from our psychology department here at UCSB, which went from being the Department of Psychology to being the Department of Psychology and Brain Sciences. So my thought is we could go from just being departments of religious studies to be departments of religion and worldview studies, with the idea that that more expansive frame allows us not only to look at religious worldviews, but also as secular worldviews, which I think that certainly for people in Europe and increasingly in the US, people are aware that there's an awful lot of folks who don't embrace religious worldviews, which may be part of why some people, other academics, think that what we do isn't that important. I think framing what we're doing in terms of worldviews and ways of life puts everybody's way of approaching these things on the table and allows us to look at secular and scientific worldviews alongside religious ones, see how they're similar and different, how certain parts of them may be shared, and then only certain things in certain contexts where there's disagreements. I think it potentially becomes a more powerful tool for looking at speaking to issues in other fields. For public policy, for anthropology, for political science, I think that we could potentially have more impact if we could bring everybody into the picture without losing the religion part, which is why I wouldn't throw out the religion name. I wouldn't just shift to worldview studies. I think the kind of religion and other worldviews frame is maybe a little bit more helpful.
Yeah, I mean, that would have been my question, would have been, if it's religion and worldviews, then why have the religion there at all? Why not just be the study of worldviews? If religion is one amongst a series of worldviews, then there's no need to foreground that one. But then the answer comes, well, because most of our colleagues are interested in religions, and we have sociology departments who also think that they study worldviews. And you see what I mean? I mean, I see it entirely from the point of view of what you're doing and from what I'm doing as well, but I can't see how we can convince the universities and the students and the policymakers of that move.
No, those are good questions. So in the course I'm teaching for lower division undergraduates, I'm calling it Comparing Religions and Other Worldviews. And that, so I do five religious, standard religious traditions and humanism. So that's how I'm doing it practically in that context. And it leaves both words in and it uses other worldviews. So it's clear that religions are also can be conceived as worldviews. But when you said that sociologists study worldviews, okay, I'll buy that. I was thinking more actually that anthropologists study worldviews, or maybe they study ways of life So we're taking terminology that, other people, or I'm taking terminology that other people would say they had a claim to. It's also terminology that Ninian Smart and some others, obviously have promoted. Mm-hmm. But people like Bill Payden emphasized religions in terms of world making. So we've got some theories of religions that start from the idea that we're making worlds. So what I'm doing here is kind of making an argument that we can't just cede this territory to the anthropologists and the sociologists. But I would stress that one of the differences between the way that Egil and I are approaching this, first the way Ninian Smart did, is Ninian Smart took categories from history of religions and applied them to other worldviews. What we're doing actually is taking sort of non-technical versions of the basic philosophical questions. So ontology, epistemology, cosmology, praxeology, etc. We're taking user-friendly versions of those questions to ground our definition of worldview. So we're ripping off from the philosophers. So in other words, I could see an argument that what we're trying to do is positioning us between sociology, anthropology, and philosophy. Mm-hmm. And saying that, I don't even quite know how to say that, say it, but sort of like the pulling together and focusing on this issue of how ways of life, worldviews are constructed in terms of the practical, everyday living out and development of these basic philosophical concepts is a way to talk about what has most drawn at least me and I suspect a bunch of other people into religious studies. So we're not sitting around, or I'm not sitting around like the philosophers in these deep discussions about, you know, how we should really think about ontology. I'm interested in how people have answered the question of what is real. And so it's more like a lived religion approach, but to worldviews and ways of life around these philosophical questions. Is this making sense? I'm making this up as I'm going here.
No, it makes sense. It's I share your position, but yeah, the practicalities of it is a whole other thing. Do you have time for one last question?
Sure.
Great. Okay, this will be a bit easier, hopefully. This comes from Owen Coggins. He asks, "What have you changed your mind about?"
That's easier.
Well, it's a simpler question. Might not be easier to answer.
What have I changed my mind about? I thought of three kinds of changes of something, if not mind. I don't know if they're changes of mind. One was shift in my research focus, which was pretty dramatic, which was around 1990 or so, and established the trajectory that I've been on since then. The second was sort of shifts in public identity as manifest by how I constructed my web page over the years. And that I say that just having redone it yesterday. And the third would be sort of how my mind has changed around my own personal religious belief and practice or whatever.
I'm interested in the second one, how you present yourself to the public.
Okay.
I haven't seen your new website yet, so I'm not sure what. I'm impressed by how deliberate that is. It sounds like you think about it a lot more than I ever do.
Well, I've been working on so much stuff lately that I haven't spent any time, you know, posting anything on academia.edu or updating my Vita, and my webpage was getting pretty out of date. So I decided that I was going to spend a day and actually sort of like consolidate rather than just push onward. Mm-hmm. And so that was the result. So what I had up on my webpage was, I guess, something that I must have written, I don't know, it could have been as long as 10 years ago, like when I, not too long after I came to UCSB. And, you know, my basic identity was the categories were American religion and history of Christianity. And then I said stuff about my research interests, and some of my books were up there and different articles and stuff like that. And the research interests were around the intersection of these different, you know, appraisals of things and whether they wound up turning into new religious movements and special things and the kind of stuff that we were talking about in the beginning and that people generally know that I've been up to. But I am no, let's put it this way. And I guess this is something for the younger people to keep in mind, is that you don't necessarily get hired to do what you, where your research is taking you, let's put it that way, that you may get hired to do things that more fit the department's idea of what bases needed to be covered. So even though I had strong theoretical interests and methodological interests, I was hired first of all to teach what at the time was called American church history, and we turned into history of Christianity and American religion. Mm-hmm. That was at Claremont. And then here I got hired because there was a chair in Catholic studies. So I turned my history of Christianity, which always included Catholicism, into Catholic studies. But that didn't really fit very well with where my research was going. And now that I'm getting closer to retirement, we turned the position, the chair, over to somebody else in the department. And that's kind of freed me to kind of go where I want to go. And so I redid my website with that in mind. Mm-hmm. And I decided I didn't have to call myself, say my field was American religion and history of Christianity. I put in that I'm doing scientific worldview studies. What was it? It was something like brain and mind, or there was something that was supposed to, experience and mind, or something like that. Something that's supposed to capture the experience part, and then theory and method. So I just blew my old identifiers out of the water. I don't know if I'll totally stick with these, but I just felt like doing something that felt a little closer to the reality of what I'm up to right now. And then I described it and I talked about the several big projects that I'm working on now. And it was just kind of fun to be at a point in my career where I could just say what I'm really doing and not have to adapt it to whatever.
that's really good. It's quite heartening. For people in, I don't know what the situation is in the US, but the idea of being able to actually put method and theory as your specialism is, I might have to wait till I'm close to retirement too, but at least I'll get there one day.
So I wanted to frame this by saying that, you know, for a long time, you know, I've been working with whatever my situation is to meet the needs of the situation as well as my own research interests, and always finding that, as you know, negotiating a balance that worked pretty well. And I mean, I've had remarkably supportive contexts that were always supporting my research, even if some of my teaching and the departmental needs were a little bit, you know, at odds with that. So I'm really not complaining here, but I'm at a point where some of those constraints are just not there in the way that they've always been. And so it's kind of fun to just sort of let loose and make up an identity that seems the most accurate right now.
And thank you so much for letting loose with us today and answering these questions. We've talked for longer than we should have. I've kept you longer than I should have. So thanks so much again for taking part.
Yep, you're welcome. It was fun.
Thank you. I'll speak to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye, David.
Bye now.
The RSP is sponsored by the British Association for the Study of Religions, the North American Association for the Study of Religion, and the International Association for the History of Religions. The Religious Studies Project is produced by the Religious Studies Project Association, SCIO, a Scottish charitable incorporated organisation, charity number SC047750. Brought to you by founders and editors-in-chief Chris Cotter and David Robertson, and managing editor Thomas J. Coleman III. Our features are edited by Marek Sullivan and Rebecca Barrett-Fox, and our opportunities digest by Ella Bock. Podcast transcription by Helen Bradstock, with audio editing by Gregory Schneider and Samuel Ward. Social media managed by Ray Radford, sales and marketing by Sammy Bishop, and video editing by Jonathan Tuckett. Don't forget, you can support the project by using our amazon.com.co.uk and .ca links, or donating at patreon.com/projectrs, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, iTunes, and other portals.